Cups!
Hello, and welcome back to the penultimate episode of my story of Magellan and his men's voyage around the world, the first circumnavigation of the globe. If you remember last time, we were in the Philippines. Magellan and his men were in the Philippines, the island of Cebu. So let's pick up the story there. So Lawrence Bergreen, in his excellent book, Over the Edge of the World, which I've been reading from, tells us that Pigafetta wrote this, quote, "At noon on Sunday, April the 7th, and we're in the year 1521, remember, we entered the port of Cebu, passing by many villages where we saw many houses built upon logs. On approaching the city, the Captain General ordered the ships to unfurl their banners. The sails were lowered and arranged as if for battle, and all the artillery was fired, an action which caused a great deal of fear to those people," end quote. Yeah, Magellan loves doing this. It's one of his sort of signature things, is firing off aquabuses or even their bigger artillery pieces from their ships. And of course, it causes massive fear and confusion among the indigenous peoples. They've never, ever heard or seen such a thing before. And of course, it would be terrifying, wouldn't it? It's like it's the only thing they would ever know, even remotely close to it, would be thunder. But he even does it. Sometimes they try to explain to these island people that, no, it's meant as a nice or good greeting. If they're going to celebrate an important day, a feast or a festival or a mass or something, to sort of celebrate that, they'll fire off their cannon. So to the Europeans, it's not scary, it's good. It's sort of cool, if you like, in a way. But obviously to the indigenous people, it's going to be terrifying. And also Magellan knows that as well. So it is like a dominance thing. Like, you know, announcing yourself and, you know, immediately saying, we're more powerful than you. We can do things you can't dream of, sort of thing. So, okay, Magellan loves doing it. Bergreen goes on. "Once the ships dropped anchor, Magellan dispatched his illegitimate son, Cristóvão Arbelo," and Pigafetta says, "as ambassador to the king of Cebu, along with the slave Enrique to serve as an interpreter. Arriving on land, Rebello and Enrique found a vast crowd of people together with the king, all of whom had been frightened by the mortars," Green says. "To reassure the distraught inhabitants, Enrique explained that it was the fleet's custom to discharge their weapons when entering such places as a sign of peace and friendship," quote. Yeah, and, you know, they're not going to necessarily know it's a sign of peace and friendship, are they? They're almost certainly not going to take it that way. But there you go, just a classic sort of miscommunication, a classic misunderstanding between two worlds. But again, I suspect, well, we kind of know as well, don't we, that Magellan and his men also knew, you know, that it would be scary for the people. His words had their intended effect, and soon the local chieftain was asking what he could do for them. Enrique stepped forward again and announced that his captain owed allegiance to, quote, "the greatest king and prince in the world," and that he was going to discover the Moluccas. Obviously, the greatest king and prince is Charles of Castile, he means Spain. And Enrique continues to explain to that his captain had decided to pass this way because of the great report that he had of him from the king of Limasawa, and to buy food, end quote. So remember, they just come from the island of Limasawa, which was very, very peaceful, very, very friendly and inviting and generous and peaceful on Limasawa. And they told Magellan, if you remember last episode, they told Magellan that go over to Cebu, they're sort of bigger, more important, richer, you know, if you're looking for trading posts and civilization, essentially, you want to go to Cebu. They're bigger and more important than us. But so they've just come from Limasawa, so remember that. And in fact, they've got the king of Limasawa with them. Say king, it's just basically like a tribal chieftain, really, is what it is. This is the king of Cebu. "Impressed, the king welcomed the visitors, but he advised, quote, it was their custom for all ships that entered their ports to pay tribute, end quote. Only 4 days before, a junk from Siam, quote, laden with gold and slaves, quote, had called on the island and paid its tribute. To back up his story, the king produced an Arab merchant from Siam who had remained behind. The merchant explained that it was necessary to pay tribute to the local rulers in exchange for safe passage, and he urged Magellan to follow his example. Now, Magellan sort of makes a tactical decision here. We're told, Magellan scorned the Arabs' live and let live approach to the islanders and refused to pay anyone. He saw the local populace as prey, as helpers, and as heathen, not as equals, and he intended to claim their territory for Spain and their souls for the church. Negotiations between Magellan and the King of Cebu broke down when Magellan, through Enrique, insisted that his king, King Charles of Castile, was the greatest in all the world, and the Armada de Molucca would never pay tribute to a lesser ruler. He ended by declaring, quote, "If the king wished peace, we would have peace, but if war instead, then he would have war," end quote. So Magellan there is being really quite belligerent. You know, people have looked back on it and thought, you know, kind of needlessly belligerent. There's no need for him to be like this. Remember, he's the first explorer in the Philippines. He really is still in uncharted waters. So there's no need for him to sort of try and claim the lands for Spain, try and convert all the people to Christianity. That wasn't in his orders, his official orders from the court of Castile. He wasn't charged with doing that. And he just doesn't have to do it. It's not part of his remit, but that's exactly what he's deciding to do. He's making a rod for his own back, Magellan. He's giving himself bigger, more difficult tasks than need be necessary. He could have just paid the King of Cebu, a guy called Humabon, or Raja Humabon. He could have just paid him some tribute. Or, you know, he could have just said, he could have just played it a number of ways rather than being haughty and sort of insisting that he's the more important party here. But that's what Magellan decides to do. Bergreen says, "At this point, the merchant from Siam uttered a few words that peak effect to mean, 'Have good care, O king.'" And in this sense, the king is talking to Magellan. "Have good care, O king, that what you do, for these men are of those who have conquered Calicut, Malacca, and all India the greater. If you give them good reception and treat them well, it will be well for you. But if you treat them ill, so much the worse it will be for you," end quote. Enrique seconded the merchant's advice. If the king of Cebu refused to yield, then the captain general would send so many men that they would destroy him, end quote. So Magellan's getting pretty aggressive straight off the bat. You know, he's been asked for some tribute, which seems to have been the normal custom. He said, "Not only am I not going to pay any tribute, but if you ask me again, if you push me on it at all, I'm just going to start attacking you." It's basically what he says. That's aggressive. Magellan hasn't really been acting like this before, has he? So it's interesting to see, again, from our point of view, looking back on it centuries later, it looks like some sort of change has come over Magellan. It's probably not necessarily the case. He probably always had these traits in him, but for whatever reason, this is how he's deciding to act at this point of the voyage. And, even despite the relatively large amount of accounts we've got from Pigafetta, from De Mafra, from one or two others, we don't know the exact detail, you know, day by day, what's going on in Magellan's head. So we can't tell exactly what his thought processes are, exactly what his calculations were to start acting like this. But this is how he decides to act at this stage of the voyage, you know, very bellicose. Bergreen says, "The king of Cebu shrewdly replied that he would confer with his chieftains and return the next day. As a sign of his peaceful intentions, he offered the landing party, quote, refreshments of many dishes, all made from meat and contained in porcelain platters beside many jars of wine," end quote. He sent them happily stumbling back to their waiting ships, where they told Magellan and the ever-present Pigafetta the details of the exchange. Despite his belligerent words, Magellan possessed one diplomatic asset, the king of Limasawa, who they brought with them, who had come along on this leg of the journey and was pleased to, quote, speak to the king of the great courtesy of our captain general, quote. So he got the king of Limasawa to speak to the king of Cebu and say, tell him that, look, these guys, you know, they sound belligerent, they're being a bit aggressive here, but they're not crazy, they're not devils, they're not, you know, they're not here just to completely do bad things, they'll barter. You know, they've actually got things that are cool that we want, you know, like beads and mirrors and cloth caps and stuff. So seems like the king of Limasawa sort of calms the situation down a bit with the king of Cebu. So we're told, Bergreen tells us, that the local king's soothing words had the desired effect, and on Monday morning, the Armada's notary, i.e. that is Pigafetta, accompanied by Enrique, held a formal meeting with the king of Cebu. That's the Raja or King Hamabon. This time, Hamabon offered to pay tribute to the most powerful king in the world rather than demanding it for himself. So it completely worked. Like Magellan's belligerence completely worked. Not only does he not need to pay any tribute to Hamabon anymore, he's going to get some in return. So you can see why Magellan might be acting like this. If he's a little bit of belligerence, like on Limasawa and on Guam and other places, a little bit of aggression has served him well. It has sort of worked out well for him so far. If you show your power a bit, most of the time, or nearly all the time so far, that's worked out well. The indigenous island peoples have just submitted to any sort of show of strength, of puffing his chest out, saber rattling. It has worked. I mean, this time, again, it seems to have worked perfectly. So you can see if that's what's going on in Magellan's mind, all he needs to do is act aggressively and he gets everything he wants. And that's repeatedly worked. Why wouldn't you keep doing that, I suppose? Okay. The impasse was broken. Magellan acknowledged Hamabon's generous offer and announced he would trade with him and no others. Prompted by the ruler of Limasawa, the Sibuan ruler offered to become blood brothers with Magellan. The captain general had only to send a drop of his blood from his right arm, and he would do the same as a sign of the most sincere friendship. Almost despite himself, Magellan had found a home in Cebu. The next day, Tuesday, Magellan had more good news. The Limasawan king announced that Hamabon was preparing a great feast to send to the ships, and that after dinner he would send two of his nephews with other notable men to make peace with him. Quote, after gratefully receiving the food, Magellan decided to make another show of force and trotted out an armour-clad seaman whose demonstrations of European-style combat predictably alarmed the Sibuan emissary, who seemed more intelligent than the others. Quote, once again, Magellan turned the situation to his advantage, Pigafetta says. The captain general told him not to be frightened, for our arms were soft towards our friends and harsh towards our enemies. And as handkerchiefs wipe off sweat, so do our arms overthrow and destroy all our adversaries and the enemies of our faith, end quote. The lesson had its intended effect, i.e., you know, the indigenous people of Cebu saw the strength, just like on Limasawa and Guam, they saw the strength of Spanish armour and arms and did realise that, you know, oh, we've got nothing like that. Armed with such things, these men could, you know, defeat us. So we'll sort of be kind and generous towards them. Bergerin goes on. Once Magellan had alternately impressed and intimidated the Sibuans, relations between the two proceeded like a tale in a storybook. The king's nephew came aboard Trinidad, accompanied by a retinue of 8 chieftains, to swear loyalty. Holding court, Magellan played the part of a magnanimous potentate with gusto. Pigafetta says, the captain general was seated in a red velvet chair, the principal men of the ships on leather chairs and the others on mats upon the floor. The captain general asked them through an interpreter whether that prince had the authority to make peace, i.e. the nephew of the king of Cebu, that prince. The captain general said many things concerning peace and that he prayed to God to confirm it in heaven. They said that they had never heard such words and that they took great pleasure in hearing them. The captain general, seeing that they listened and answered willingly, began to advance arguments to induce them to accept the faith, end quote. So again, right away, Magellan's getting involved in religion and the job of converting these people, you know, missionary work. And once again, that's not his job. That's not his orders to do that. He hasn't been massively interested in that before, you know, when they were sailing down the coast of Patagonia and Brazil and things. It didn't seem to be like that was his main goal in any way. But now it seems like it is sort of one of the most, perhaps even the most important thing to Magellan. Now, you'll see how all this plays out, that it seems like, once again, it's probably not the case, but it just seemed like something switched in his mind at this point, and converting them to Christianity is sort of the most important thing to him. But okay, I'll carry on. Bergerin says, rising from his special chair, Magellan abruptly changed the subject, wanting to know who would succeed the king after his death. Pigafetta says, they replied that the king had no son, but many daughters, and that this prince, who was his nephew, had as wife the king's eldest daughter, and for love of her, he was called prince. And they said, moreover, that when the father of the nephew were old, no more account was taken of them, but the children commanded them. End quote. That's interesting, isn't it? Quite a lot of societies aren't like that. You know, old people are revered, and unless, you know, they're so old that they're sort of senile or bedridden. You know, usually older people are revered. But in this culture, in this society, at this time, at a certain point, old people are just commanded by their children, or so we're told. And that's very un-Christian, really. That's quite un-Catholic, that sort of state of affairs. So Bergreen says, this state of affairs struck Magellan as contradictory to the commandments, and he proceeded to explain some basic tenets of the Bible. Pigafetta wrote, God made the sky, the earth, the sea, and everything else, and that he had commanded us to honour our fathers and mothers, and that whoever did otherwise was condemned to eternal fire, that we are all descended from Adam and Eve, our first parents, that we have an immortal spirit. His oratory must have been highly persuasive, because all joyfully entreated the captain general to leave them two men, or at least one, to instruct them in the faith. End quote. Bergreen goes on. Magellan explained that he could not leave anyone behind with them, but if they wished, the Armada's priest, Father Valderrama, would gladly baptize the Sibuens, and when they returned, they would bring, like, some other year, like maybe years from now, when they come back again, they don't, this particular group of Europeans don't, but they say, when they returned, they would bring priests and friars to instruct them. Pigafetta reported that the chieftains, Magellan, and the onlookers all became so excited by the prospect that everyone, quote, wept with great joy, quote. What significance the highly emotional baptismal rite held for the Filipinos can only be guessed, but it meant something very specific to Magellan. Baptism, a word derived from the Greek baptismos, meant immersion and carried with it the idea of cleansing the soul of sin and rebirth into the Christian faith. Before he began in earnest, Magellan cautioned the Sibuens not to convert to Christianity simply to win his favour, and promised not to cause any displeasure to those who wished to live according to their own law. But, he said, the Christians would get preferential treatment. Pigafetta says, all cried out with one voice that they were not becoming Christians through fear or to please us, but of their own free will. And Magellan was so encouraged by this response that he promised to leave behind a suit of armour, just one, in gratitude. So that's an interesting point. We're told that at this stage, Magellan says, you know, I want you to. It'd be great if you all converted to Christianity. That would be brilliant. That's exactly what I really, really, really want. But you don't have to. And certainly if you're doing it under coercion or under duress, or out of fear, or you're just trying to curry favour with me, don't do it. You need to genuinely accept it, you know, accept Jesus into your heart. You have to do it of your own free will. And if you don't want to, you know, we won't hurt you or anything, but we are going to give preferential treatment to those that do. Now, this comes up because quite quickly, that's not the deal that Magellan is offering. Quite quickly, it becomes convert or we might burn down your houses and maybe kill you. Like very quickly, within days, that becomes the deal. But at this early stage, he's still saying, you don't have to. And, you know, you have to do it out of your own free will. And, you know, there's no punishment if you don't. But it was absolutely not Magellan's job to start threatening and bullying indigenous island folk of Southeast Asia into becoming Christian. But that's how it goes. Okay, Bergreen continues. He also raised the highly sensitive subject of sex between his men and the Sibuen women. Pigafetta says, we could not have intercourse with their women without committing a very great sin, since they were pagans, and he assured them that if they became Christians, the devil would no longer appear to them except in the last moment of their death. End quote. Bergreen continues. Magellan implied that it was a lesser sin to become intimate with Sibuen women who had been baptized, and the crew, as ravenous for sex as they were for food, immediately took advantage of the loophole. But there is no suggestion that Magellan himself became intimate with any of the Sibuen women. He found fulfillment of a more spiritual nature. Pigafetta again. The captain embraced them weeping, and clasping one of their prince's hands and one of the king's between his own, said to them that he would give them perpetual peace with the king of Spain. End quote. Okay, so in Bergreen's book, over the next few pages, quite a few pages actually, he goes on and on about sex. So let's talk about that a little bit, because it becomes important. The men stay on Cebu, or in this part of the Philippines, for quite a while, in this region anyway. And there's lots of sex going on, because these particular indigenous peoples are quite open, quite free promiscuous. I mean that with that, not as a pejorative, but they're just, the women are quite free. And the men, unlike on Guam, if you remember, the men don't seem to mind particularly. That it's a polygamous society. So the men will have many, many quote-unquote wives. They'll have one principal wife, but on top of that, they'll have many wives. And so, yeah, it's just one of those societies where, yeah, there isn't any, hardly any stigma or prudishness about sex. So, and the women go around topless quite often, if not sometimes just completely naked. So, yeah, so as you can imagine, whenever possible, sex is going on. Okay, so one of the things to mention is that they do it very differently. And as I say, in Bergring's books and in other books about this, there's usually an aside at this stage all about it. So there's a thing in this part of the world which gets called palang. And what it is some sort of genital jewellery that the men wear. It's described as like a bolt straight through the penis. I mean, there's something similar now. I haven't got any piercings, personally, if you want to know. Certainly not downstairs. But that's a thing, isn't it? Some people got that. Is it like a Prince Albert? I don't even know what it's called. But a big bolt straight through your dick, right? Pretty serious. I mean, I think you can, if you're not careful, certainly in the pre-modern age, and it's not a professional doing it, you might like some serious blood vessels or whatever. But anyway, apparently all the men have got this bolt through their dick, right? And there's even described as that there's even like some barbs on it. So, okay. And their fashion of having sex is, I mean, I don't want to get too explicit here, but is not to sort of thrust in and out, but just to like go inside and then just hold it there, because otherwise it would be too brutal. It would damage the woman, wouldn't it? It would be too much, be too aggressive. It could get internally wound the woman. So there's no real thrusting. You just hold it there. And apparently for hours and hours, or even as long as a day, you're just locked in this embrace for like a day, maybe, or certainly hours and hours. And that's how they did it. That was how they did it. And so to Pigafetta and these Europeans, that's sort of entirely new. They've never heard of or seen anything like it. And to them, they think it's weird. You can imagine. They think it's weird. They think it's a, quote, brutal custom. And they describe it as a bizarre sexual custom. You know, different folks, different strokes, right? Whatever floats your boat. But the 16th century Europeans thought it was weird and bizarre. I mean, okay, this quick paragraph from Bergring sort of sums it up. It says, quote, Pigafetta's clinical description contained enough details to suggest that he observed the islanders having intercourse, and he came away both excited and dismayed by what he saw. And these are his words. Those people make use of that device, the penis piercing of palang. Those people make use of that device because they are of a weak nature. He thought that made them weak. And he equated weakness with pleasure loving. Like the fact that they had intercourse for hours and hours and hours on end, to Pigafetta's mind, that made them weak. And he went on to explain that, quote, they have as many wives as they wish, but one of them is their principal wife, Bergreen says. Both the practice of palang, with its emphasis on increasing pleasure, and polygamy, which Pigafetta associated with it, ran counter to Catholic teachings. For all these reasons, Pigafetta found palang disconcerting, and to prove his point, he insisted, quote, all the women loved us very much more than their own men, quote, presumably because the unadorned Europeans lacked the cumbersome accessories. For the Armada de Mallorca and the Spanish expeditions that followed, palang was just one of many unacceptable customs practised by the islanders. It was said that the Filipino families of the ruling class resorted to infanticide by burying the victims or hurling them into the sea. Also, unmarried women regularly underwent abortions to make it easier to find a husband. Virginity was actually considered such a serious liability, i.e. it's bad to be a virgin for them, you know, very different to 16th century Spanish Catholics, but they considered virginity to be considered such a serious liability that professional deflowerers could be engaged to take care of the problem. The Filipinos emphasized female sexual pleasure, and women even had access to artificial penises to assuage their lust. The Spanish, especially the clergy who came after Magellan, were intent on eliminating the practice, which they felt was nearly as repugnant as Palang itself. It is said that Magellan's do-or-die emphasis on conversion interfered with precious cultural traditions, but he saw matters quite differently. He was engaged in a mission to rescue a benighted people from barbarism in this world and perdition in the next. In contrast to his pragmatic crew members, who considered themselves travellers through an alien landscape, Magellan conducted himself as if he were an instrument of the Lord. He believed that Providence had sent him to the Philippines to bring Christianity to the heathen, and considered the local customs as grave social ills. In Magellan's mind, Christianity offered the best and the only cure. End quote. So, okay, back to the narrative, the main narrative of the story. After Magellan has started his process of sort of insisting that he and by extension the King of Spain are the most important actors in this whole thing, that they're the center stage. All the indigenous peoples must sort of bow down to them, and beyond that will need to accept, should really, but very soon need to accept Christianity. They have a great feast, and there's a lot about this great feast, but I won't necessarily bore you with all the details of that. And then the next evening, Bergreen tells us, when Magellan finally left Trinidad to make his triumphal entry into Cebu, the next day, sort of a formal entry onto Cebu, the occasion proved every bit as majestic as he could have wished. A delegation from the ships, including an excited pigafetta, landed on Cebu to formally meet Humabon. Dressed in regal splendour to greet his guests, and these are Pigafetta's words, when we reached the city, we found the king in his palace, surrounded by many people. He was seated on a palm mat on the ground, with only a cotton cloth before his private parts, and scarf embroidered with the needle about his head, and necklace of great value hanging from his neck, and two large gold earrings fastened to his ears, set around with precious gems. He was fat and short, and tattooed with fire in various designs. From another mat on the ground, he was eating turtle eggs, which were in two porcelain dishes, and he had four jars full of palm wine in front of him, covered with sweet-smelling herbs and arranged with four small reeds in each jar by means of which he drank. Having duly made reverence to him, the interpreter, Enrique, told the king that his master thanked him very warmly for his present, and that he sent this present not in return for his present, but for the intrinsic love which he bore for him. We dressed him in the robe, placed the cap on his head, and gave him other things. Then kissing the beads and putting them on his head, I presented them to him. He doing the same, accepted them. The king had us eat some of those eggs and drank through those slender reeds. The king wished to have us stay to supper with him, but we told him that we could not stay. End quote. So again, all seems to be going fairly well. The exchange of gifts, and on some level, Humabon has accepted Magellan as sort of the senior partner here on some level. Bergreen continues. Impressive as they were, these exchanges were a mere prelude. The excitement began when the prince escorted Pigafetta and several others to his raised hut. They climbed ladders and within found four young girls were playing, one on a drum like ours, but resting on the ground. The second was striking two suspended gongs alternately with a stick wrapped somewhat thickly at the end with a palm cloth. The third, one large gong in the same manner, and the fourth, two small gongs held in her hand by striking one against the other, which gave forth a sweet sound. They played so harmoniously that one would believe that they possessed a good musical sense. End quote. They seem surprised that they're capable of using any sort of instrument. Okay, Bergreen says, the Europeans noticed more the musical ability. The girls were bare-breasted and extremely alluring. Pigafetta writes, these girls were very beautiful and almost as white as our girls and as large. They were naked except for palm cloths hanging from their waist and reached to their knees. Some were quite naked and had large holes in their ears with a small round piece of wood in the hole. They have long black hair and wear a short cloth about their head and are always barefoot. The prince had three quite naked girls dance before us. And that's the end of Pigafetta's account of that. But Bergreen says, reluctant to contradict Magellan's prohibition against intercourse with native women until they converted to Christianity, Pigafetta refrains from describing the frolicking and lovemaking with the female musicians, but he leaves no doubt about the evening's outcome. All around them, similar celebrations of European Cebuan amity involving ordinary villagers and sailors were taking place that night. The one question is whether Magellan participated, but given his restraint and self-denial throughout the voyage, it is unlikely that he yielded to the temptations of the flesh even on this occasion. So, a great night. That was always one of the things that would draw men to go out to sea, even up to the 19th century, or perhaps even in the 20th century. You go abroad, you go all the way around the world for the hope of treasure and fame and adventure and women. Tahiti is famous. Tahiti isn't in this story, but in centuries to come, in decades and centuries to come, Tahiti becomes famous for that the women are really, really beautiful and really, really easy, for want of a better word. So yeah, if you're sort of a young man, sort of a kind of crazy young man, you're prepared to risk your life. You're looking for money and women. So the sailors finally get a bit of it here in the Philippines. Okay, Bergreen goes on. When they returned to the ships that night, the four emissaries were greeted with sobering news. Two shipmates lay near death. The next morning, April the 10th, Martin Beretta, a passenger, succumbed to the lingering effects of the scurvy he had suffered during the 98 days of the Pacific crossing. Hours later, Juan de Areche, a sailor, breathed his last. In the morning, Pigafetta and Enrique returned to the island to make arrangements for Christian burials for both men. Really important that, you know, you have to have a bit of consecrated ground. You know, they've got their Father Valderrama, who can consecrate a small piece of ground, and they can be buried there and the correct prayers and things said over them. And then, you know, their souls can at least potentially go to heaven. If you don't do those things, then, you know, it's bad news for your eternal soul. And so they start doing those things. They make arrangements for Christian burials for both men, which meant consecrating a cemetery on Cebu, complete with a cross. The king of Cebu, as accommodating as ever, said he wished to worship the cross as soon as it was erected. Magellan turned the occasion into a religious lesson for the islanders' benefit. Pigafetta writes, "The deceased was buried in the square with as much pomp as possible in order to furnish a good example. Then we consecrated the place and in the evening buried another man." If you enjoyed that preview, please consider heading over to lotuseaters.com to watch the full unabridged video.